Welcome to Season 3 of the Unscripted Medicine Podcast, a podcast by medical students who live and learn at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine.
On the show, we host a variety of discussions such as navigating the preclinical and clinical years, exploring humanism in medicine, and developing our physician identities outside of the textbook.
Check out the show notes or our website for more information, helpful links, resources, and more.
Please connect with us via email or on Twitter at @unscripted_med. We would love to hear from you. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, my name is Alex Gelati, and I'm currently an M3 and one of the hosts on the Unscripted Medicine podcast team. On today's episode, my co-host Rachel Holloway and I sit down with Dr. Kelly to discuss handling patient or colleague-generated microaggressions. Dr. Kelly is a board-certified ophthalmologist, is currently the director of the Advancing Inclusion in Medical Education Task Force, course director for Physician and Society 201 and 202, and the director of Medical Student Education in Ophthalmology, all at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. She earned her medical degree at Harvard Medical School and completed her residency at Stanford Medical School. Dr. Kelly proceeded to get her fellowship in corneal transplantation at the Harvard University, Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary. Now let's dive into today's episode.
So welcome to the show, Dr. Kelly. It's such an honor to have you on the show with us today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I am delighted to be here with both of you and really excited about the topic that we're going to talk about today.
So the episode that we're going to delve into right now is going to be kind of about handling patient or colleague, you know, generated microaggressions. And before we get too deep into the conversation, I think it might be helpful for not only us, but for our listeners to at first define, you know, like what is a microaggression and like discrimination? Are they the same? What's the difference?
Well, Alex, I think that's a really great place to start. Microaggressions have become pretty much a buzzword. A lot of people talk about microaggressions, but sometimes you're not sure whether everybody is talking about exactly the same thing. So it's a good idea to just take a step back and think about it just a little bit before we dive into how one addresses them and some of the challenges. And although it's a current buzzword, it really is not a new concept at all. The first person to describe microaggressions was really an African-American psychiatrist at Harvard back in the 1970s who realized that marginalized people were facing a new category of challenge. In the past, in the pre-civil rights era, people could really recognize very egregious forms of racism and sexism. It was really very obvious to everyone. You know, names that people were called, very offensive types of actions. Mm-hmm. But as people began to integrate more into more diverse environments, these new subtle types of everyday racism started to evolve that were much more subtle and much more difficult to really understand. And so his name was Chester Pierce, a physician in Boston, and it wasn't really worked on very much until the early 2000s when a professor at Columbia Teachers College, Gerald Sue, took a closer look at it and expanded it to groups outside of African Americans. So it became a term that was used to marginalized groups of all categories. So women, people to address ableism, sexism, ageism, all various categories started to come under the category, the umbrella of microaggression. And he also developed a taxonomy, a vocabulary, so that people could describe it and understand what was going on with microaggressions in a way that didn't really exist when Dr. Pierce first described it back in the 70s. So that's kind of the history of it. And in terms of a definition, I am going to do something that I don't ordinarily do, but I have Daryl Sue's description of microaggression, and it's so important to get the definition right. If you'll allow me to read it, and then I promise I won't read anything else on the podcast.
Absolutely.
So according to Daryl Sue, in his definition, microaggressions are brief, commonplace, daily verbal or behavioral or environmental indignities, whether they are intentional or unintentional, that communicate hostile, derogatory, or negative racial slights or insults towards people of color. And that sense has been really broadened to address all marginalized people. And so I think what's really important in that description is several things, that it is daily. It's the lived life, the daily in and out lives of people who are marginalized. They're not these exceptional events, but day to day. The other thing is that they are targeted towards that person's marginalized status. So it's not just being rude to somebody, but it's being rude to them in the context of them being of a certain gender or of a certain sexual orientation or ethnic group. That's really the root of the insult or the slight or indignity. And then the last thing that's really important to recognize is that I think most people would be horrified at the thought of being called racist or sexist and would go a long distance not to be that. Mm-hmm. But microaggressions include intentional and unintentional slights. So sometimes people who are very, very well-meaning and would not ordinarily dream to be offensive to someone might actually commit a microaggression.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question for you. That was all super great. Thank you for that information and that definition, because I think it's so helpful to establish and define what microaggressions are and how they occur in daily life. So that was super helpful. Thank you. My next question that you kind of just answered was that do people mean to do these microaggressions in their daily life? I mean, like you mentioned, with all of the things that have happened in the past year, a lot of anti-racism educational material has gone out, and a lot of it has been like, I know that you don't mean to be racist, but what you are doing is actually racist. And unless you're being actively anti-racist, in many forms, you would be considered racist. And that's not a personal attack on you. It's just the way that you have been raised or equivalent to that. So my question to you was going to be, is microaggression something that someone sets out to do, that they knowingly do, or is it just due to miseducation or a lack of awareness about what microaggressions are?
Rachel, that is, I think, really the foundational question in microaggressions. And the short answer to that is, no, people do not intend to be racist or offensive. Mm-hmm. Going back to Daryl Sue and his original work with microaggressions, he describes really three categories of microaggressions. And the first is what's called a microassault. And a microassault looks like good old-fashioned racism or sexism. The person very often knows what they're doing. They say and do things that are pretty egregious. And I think most people would agree that that's the type of behavior that most people go a long distance to. Mm-hmm. The second category of microaggression are called microinsults. And very often, ironically, people do these things and they think they're actually extending a compliment. Not only are they not intending to be racist or sexist, they may say something that they think is a compliment. So for instance, an example would be some patient encounters a woman who is his or his physician and says, oh, I think you're just too pretty to be a doctor. And that patient may think that they're extending a compliment. Mm. Or somebody may say to an African-American person who is delivering a paper, you are so articulate. And with the kind of the meta context behind it is that because people of your group are not particularly articulate, and so it's surprising to me, or I'm extending this compliment. And we all have biases. It's just the way we're hardwired. And so sometimes these biases, implicit biases, really percolate up to the surface and manifest themselves in a microaggression. And so very often it's the person who is the microaggressor doesn't really even understand that they've done or said something that is offensive in some way.
Yeah.
I think it was great that you provided examples, because I feel like just for our listeners and even for ourselves to hear examples of what could be considered microaggressions, and then realizing like, oh, I may do that, or I have seen that, and
or I've experienced it personally.
I've experienced it, yeah.
Yeah.
Especially like kind of growing up half my life in the South, a lot of people use like sweetheart and stuff like that, and realizing if the person's not from the South or if they don't like that, to them that could be considered, you know, a micro insult. Like, how dare you call me sweetheart? Like, that seems condescending.
You know, you bring up such a great point, Alex. And with microaggressions, very often it's not that one episode and people are like, well, what's the big deal that that happened? But microaggressions are cumulative. They layer on each other. So you imagine a woman who's a physician who has maybe been in a meeting where her opinions are not taken as seriously or is not part of the discussion. The woman is at the bedside and the patient continues to talk to the male doctors instead of to her. And then somebody calls her sweetie or honey. It's cumulative. They build on each other. So it's not just that one incident, it's the cumulative effect. And that's true of all marginalized people who are on the target end of microaggressions. It's often not that one episode. And that's why people will sometimes say, oh, you're too sensitive, or it was just a joke, or relax, because that is not their world experience of having had those cumulative episodes that have happened.
Yeah, and I think that you mentioning the cumulative effect of these microaggressions made me think about intersectionality in a lot of people, whether that be a patient, a physician, a colleague. Like, everyone has these different parts of them that make them who they are. And I think that part of that cumulative effect is potentially these microaggressions accumulating on each other because they are coming from all of these different angles, if that makes sense. Because we've talked a lot about racism and we've talked a lot about gender, but I'm sure that there are other aspects that can be targets of microaggression as well.
Absolutely. And the third category of microaggression is micro-invalidation. And a micro-invalidation is negating somebody's worldview. We all come to our practice of medicine with different life experiences. And what you may be sensitive about may be very different from what I am sensitive to and about. And recognizing that we all come to medicine with these different life experiences, as you refer to, and we have different privileges and different, you know, kind of assortments of our privilege categories and areas where we may be of a marginalized group, and to be appreciative that that influences how we perceive interactions. And so, for instance, a microaggression that would be in the category of a micro invalidation would be someone saying, oh, you're too serious about things. That was just a joke, or I don't think she meant anything by that, or he meant anything by that. And ironically, we're so eager to not want to be labeled as sexist or homophobic or racist, that sometimes the response is, oh, I didn't mean anything by that. Some of my best friends are. I'm colorblind. I couldn't possibly. And what that does is the person is trying to take a big step away from being homophobic or being racist. But what happens is they're actually offering a second microaggression, which is a micro invalidation of saying, I don't think your interpretation of what happened is legitimate. I am delegitimizing how you are viewing this action. And unfortunately, in that attempt to distance, which is understandable, no one wants to carry a really negative label, but what people do in that context often is to make things even more challenging for the person who was the target of the microaggression.
Yeah. Yeah. What you mentioned, it brings up two things that I might want to clarify. So we speak about micro invalidation. Is that kind of like gaslighting, or are those different concepts, or could be in one could be included into the other? And then the other is for the other two pillars of microaggressions, how are they different from discrimination?
Both really good questions. It is a very close relation. It's not exactly the same thing as gaslighting. I think very often when people invalidate the realities of other people and their lived experience, it's not done intentionally. I think it's more done in an attempt to protect a person's own self-identity. Mm-hmm. You know, who wants to think of themselves with these labels? And it's an attempt to distance back from that. And that's a bit different from gaslighting, but it can have a similar effect on the person who's the target. In terms of the different categories of microaggression and their relationship to discrimination, the way that I like to look at it is that it is a biased and unfair treatment of people of a marginalized group. So identifying somebody in that marginalized group and then having a different set of treatment or rules for people who are in that group. Microaggressions are a subset of discrimination. So it is a discrimination, but a subset. So for instance, there are some policies that are discriminatory. Mm-hmm. There are some laws that are potentially people think are discriminatory. Microaggression is a type of discrimination. So for instance, there may be a policy that discriminates against me, but I might not be aware of that policy. That it may be a hiring policy, it may be any type of policy, and I may be a victim of that and never know it. Microaggressions are that day-to-day interaction, and typically when there's a microaggression, I know that a microaggression has happened towards me. So it is a form of discrimination that lives under that broader umbrella of discriminatory acts.
Thank you for that clarification. I think it's really helpful to kind of know the differences, especially when we have these discussions or are using terminology that we're using it appropriately. So thank you. That was very helpful. Kind of on the topic, we've discussed examples and talked about how, you know, one could encounter these as they're practicing medicine, whether it be as a medical student, resident, or full-fledged physician. And I just wonder, how best can we handle these situations when, you know, you brought up the example when the patient is only talking to our male counterparts, or then they say, oh, well, you're too pretty to be a physician or something like that. How do we best handle that especially with patients, without having it impact our care?
That therein lies the challenge. Don't you just love it when somebody says, let's just take a step back and look at the bigger picture. Whenever there's a microaggression, it always happens in a context. So that context might be a classroom, a social gathering, at the patient's bedside. And the context very often influences how you may handle a microaggression. Mm. Most of the work that's been done on microaggression points out that there are typically three people who are involved. It's the person who's the aggressor, mm-hmm. it's the person who's the target, and then the person who's either an ally or a bystander. And there are differences between who's a bystander and an ally, and perhaps we'll talk about that a little bit later on. So how you handle a certain situation not only depends on the context, the situation, but also the person who is the aggressor, and whether that aggressor, your perception is that that is somebody who will be amenable to education. So coming back, Rachel, to what you said, if your perception is that this is somebody who would never want to be seen as somebody who's sexist or racist, this is somebody who really wants to learn, and they would appreciate your saying, say, I empathize, I know you would never want to be perceived in this way, let me tell you how I perceived it and how it made me feel. If it is somebody that you think is more in that micro assault category, who is really not amenable to being educated in that environment, you might take a different approach. Also, we have to talk about sometimes there are status differences. And so while you might feel very comfortable speaking to a resident, perhaps a classmate, absolutely, you might not feel quite as comfortable speaking to somebody who is grading you on a clerkship. And so that certainly fits into how one might handle it. The other is being the target of it. And being the target, you might be well experienced in handling such situations, and you might feel quite comfortable to approach someone and say, hey, you know, I didn't like how you said I felt this way. Or you might be tired, you might be emotionally at the end of your rope, and you might just feel like, I don't have the emotional energy to take this on right now. So all of those things kind of go into the equation of how you handle it. And I'd like at some point to talk about how you prepare yourself for certain situations, how you evaluate it, and what your options are in a certain situation, whether you handle it in that moment, and how you protect yourself emotionally. And if you choose not to handle it in that moment, what some of the options are for you to address a microaggression later on.
Yeah, I think we would love to hear those scenarios, especially as people where this could possibly happen in a few short mm-hmm. months to them while on rotations. I think we would love to hear the difference between, you know, steps to do and how to prepare yourself, how to best approach it if you have that bandwidth, and then how best to take care of yourself afterwards, because it can be a big burden and draining to have to constantly bring things up to people.
And what we have found out on your last point, Alex, is that the cost of either approaching somebody who has issued a microaggression towards you, or deciding to let it go and not address it, the emotional cost is high for both. There mm-hmm. is a price tag on both ends. And it's cumulative. It's quite cumulative. And what we're really learning is that it's highly associated with burnout. And there is something in the literature that is referred to as fatigue. So battle fatigue, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. And it is a cumulative effect of that. So let's say an example would be a colleague of yours says something that is clearly a microaggression, and you are the target of the microaggression. Things that you might want to do in advance of just kind of being prepared are, first of all, to have a good support system around you. particularly if you're in a marginalized group. We know that having good support systems go a great distance in terms of wellness. The other is mentoring, to have mentors that you can reach out to brainstorm with, to say, here's what happened. How do you think I should handle this? And having that support in place before. The other is taking good care of yourself. Being well and as rested and as centered as you can be going into situations is really helpful for your well-being in terms of handling microaggressions. And then practice. Having some phrases, just being comfortable with having certain things to come off your tongue. And what can often happen in a microaggression, and you, the people who took physician in society may remember that we talked about emotional intelligence and amygdala hijack. And very often when you're in those sorts of situations, you can almost feel like you're under attack and you get into brain freeze and you just can't think clearly and you don't know what to say and you don't know what to do. And being well rested and having an approach or a strategy that you can use when you're perhaps not emotionally at your best because of what has just happened can be very helpful. So those are the things that you want to have really in advance that will help you kind of going into the situation. When you go into the situation or you find yourself in a situation that is more apt, then you have to look at the situation, decide what is best for you to do. And kind of the fork in the road is, do I concentrate on my emotional and physical well-being in this moment? Do I do what is best for my well-being? And it may be that what's best for your well-being is to step away from the situation in that moment. If somebody is doing something that is really a macro assault, where you physically feel unsafe, you emotionally feel unsafe, then you need to pull away from that situation. That is not a situation that you would want to engage or address. But if you have kept your composure through the amygdala hijack, you've looked at the situation and you feel that this is something that I really feel that I want to address, then one of the ways that you may opt to address it, if there is kind of a hierarchical difference and you don't feel comfortable addressing something head on, maybe to basically change the topic, to derail that conversation, to pull it away from what's going on. That may be a way to protect a patient, to protect yourself, to move to a different topic that is unseemly, that you don't want to have go forward, but you don't feel that you want to address in a head-to-head fashion. So that is one option. The other option is to take on the person who, I hate to say the word committed, but had the microaggression. And the way that you can approach that is there are several models that are out there, and they're all variations on a theme. I'm not going to really get caught up on the different models, but what they all really boil down to is asking the person who committed the microaggression for a clarification. Mm-hmm. And very often that clarification is, did I just hear you say whatever it is? And very often when people hear their words back to them, they think, oh, man, wow, that really wasn't very good. And sometimes just hearing it back, that clarification. And then it might be asking them, I'm curious, why do you think that all X people are thus? And that is this, it's not a very emotionally engaged, but it's coming to it with curiosity. You've said this, I want to understand. And then after that is, here is my thought about it. Mm-hmm. Here is how I felt in this situation. And then after that, this is what I'm going to ask you to do. This is what I'm going to need to have you to do. If we are to stay in this team, in this interaction, in this relationship. And that would be the structure of almost all of the frameworks in terms of how you would engage somebody. That presumes that this is somebody who is amenable to learning from their microaggression.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My question to you was going to be, this sounds like someone who maybe is more receptive to constructive feedback, we'll put it that way. But what if you are encountering a colleague or someone, just someone who has committed a microaggression who gets defensive or isn't receptive to hearing this feedback or having these conversations? How do you approach that?
And that is a frequent challenge, is that when you are in this triad of the microaggressor, the person who is the target, and the ally, everybody has something at risk, right? The person who is the microaggressor could be labeled as a racist, a sexist, or a homophobe. So mm-hmm. they are very defensive, and they will take a big step away from that. The person who is the target runs the risk of being seen as hypersensitive, can't take a joke, makes a mountain out of a molehill. And that's why very often people just decide to let microaggressions go by. They are afraid that there will be some sort of repercussion. People very often want a good grade. They want a good residency. They want a good letter of recommendation. And they may know full well that a microaggression just happened, but they may opt because they don't want to be perceived as just making a mountain out of a molehill. They will let it go by. And then the person who is the ally or the bystander might be labeled as a coward, as somebody mm-hmm. who doesn't stand up. And so in that dynamic, a lot of people are trying to protect their reputation or their self-concept. And so you will certainly run into people who will be defensive about even the thought of being perceived that way. One thing, though, is it depends on how large a microaggression it is in terms of what you do next. There's always the option to not respond to the microaggression in the moment. And that may be because you think the situation is not appropriate. You may be at a patient's bedside and it's a coworker or such. It may be because of the hierarchical difference that you feel that you don't want to address it. You may just be exhausted in the moment mm-hmm. and not feel that you want to take it on. And so the other option is to defer it. And you may defer it and never address it because you are fearful. You don't think it's a big enough microaggression and you don't want to take it on. I'm not passing a value judgment on that. People use their best judgment in the moment as to what they want to do, what they think is best for them and safest. The other is to table it for another time. Sometimes people need to process it a little bit. What really just happened here? Yeah. And I'm going to walk away and think about this a bit. And then whoever was the cause of that microaggression, I may go back to him or her at a later date and say, you know, what you said yesterday, I had a moment to think about that. And I wanted to talk with you about that. And sometimes just giving yourself that breathing room is of value. And sometimes when you step away, you think about it and you say, no, I think this is really too big for me to take on myself. I don't feel comfortable. This doesn't feel safe for me. I don't think this person is going to learn from it. And this is too big for me to let it go and too big for me to take it on by myself. And that's where you report things. Mm-hmm. That's where it really becomes important to bring in resources from the school, from the hospital, to your aid, because it really is too big of an issue for you to safely take on by yourself.
Yeah, I think that's such a great few points, is that there are just so many options that could be going on, and these are thoughts that the person has to think, and it can add to like the stress and turmoil they kind of feel inside. I just wanted to backtrack a little bit. I know you gave us a few examples of like go-to phrases, but I was wondering if you'd be willing to provide a little more, because personally, I'm the type of person, I either need, you know, space to think back, or if I'm not, I'm like pushed over the edge, I just kind of like say it, which might not be handled in the most professional or best way to get the person to listen. For example, like I've heard if someone says like a joke that you're not funny, you could just not laugh. And then you could be like, oh, what's funny about, like, I don't get it. And then if they have to explain the joke, then they're less likely to continue jokes like that. Mm-hmm. Do you have any other like go-to phrases that are quick that we can keep in our back pockets?
Yes. Yeah, so they all kind of fall under the category of making what is hidden visible. And so when we mentioned, did I hear you say X? That's taking something that is implicit and unspoken, kind of this meta context, and bringing it out into the open where everybody is able to hear and see it. And that very often, making the invisible visible is sufficient to have people to question what they're doing. So to your point, Alex, if somebody is telling a joke, you can say, I'm not sure what was funny about that joke, or I didn't find anything funny about that joke. I'm curious why you would think that joke would be funny. But to really get to the kind of the heart of it is, I don't find that to be funny, and mm-hmm. please don't tell those sorts of jokes around me. Mm-hmm. And so it invites the person to take a look at themselves and their own implicit bias, but very quickly on the heels of that to say, I don't find that funny, and I would appreciate that whenever you're around me that you not tell those types of jokes.
Yeah, something else that I kind of have seen people say in these kinds of situations that seems to be helpful in progressing the conversation forward is, oh, what did you mean by that when you said this? And then it forces them to say, oh, I meant this. And by clarifying their intentions of saying this, you can say, okay, well, here is how I heard this. Here is how this made me feel. You might not have intended to cause any harm with that statement, but some people might find it to be offensive, or some people might be traumatized from that. And so I just need you to know that this is how it could be construed, and that you should refrain from saying things like that in the future. Because I think that, like, sometimes people can be, we use the word defensive, they can get very heated when you come and attack them and what they perceive to be you attacking them personally and you calling them racist and things like that. But if you can kind of shift the focus of the conversation, you're addressing what they're saying, but if you can shift it to say, okay, this is how it could be construed, they might be more amenable to opening their mind to that possibility.
I think that is just a perfect explanation of particularly how somebody is a supportive bystander or ally. That model that you just mentioned works beautifully for that, Rachel. And it is very empathetic in its approach. It's very non-judgmental. It mm-hmm. seeks clarification. I want to make sure that I understand what you said. I think I know you well enough that you would not want to be misperceived. And if you persist in that type of joke, language, statement, there's a high probability that you will be perceived as somebody who is racist, sexist, homophobic. Right. And here is what I heard, and here is my recommendation, or it can even be more explicit what I'm going to ask you not to do.
Right.
I'm around.
Yeah.
I just kind of want to dive in a little bit into how we've talked about how to possibly handle it, but like personally, how have the way you've handled possibly, you know, microaggressions or discrimination changed from, we've talked about the whole hierarchy and how that made influence what you do and do not do. And I know a lot of M3s feel that way. Like, oh, I thought I would feel I'd have more strength to stand up for myself than they do. And I was just curious, how has your method changed from when you were a medical student to a resident to now being a full established physician?
Full-fledged. and it has changed. It's changed a lot, and it's changed for two reasons. First of all, I think it is so powerful to have a vocabulary for us to be able to discuss these things that happen. It is interesting to me that as I talk to M3s and M4s, there are still people who are the targets of microaggressions, and they don't even realize that they just realize that they're something bad happened. They felt awful. And the challenge with that is then you can internalize certain things. So if someone suggests that you're doing something poorly or there's some inadequacy and you don't understand the vocabulary, what microaggressions are, and then if you say something, then someone says, no, you're too sensitive, that didn't really happen, then that negates your interpretation entirely. So the only thing that you're left with is, I'm not doing a good job. There's something wrong with how I'm performing. And so I think it's very valuable to have this terminology, the understanding of what microaggressions are. And when I was an M3, M4, I did not have this vocabulary. So when I look back at things, I thought, oh yeah, that was a microaggression. That was a microaggression. But in the moment, I didn't have that. And boy, I surely wish that I did. It would have given me a much more clarity about what was really going on. So that certainly has changed. So the more I understand the dynamics that happen, the more it aids me in being able to sort out, how will I handle this? And it gives me a bigger toolkit to understand what's going on and what my options are in terms of addressing inequities. The other is what you alluded to, which is where you are in the hierarchy of things. And I can certainly remember being in situations as an M3, M4, where I didn't want to rock the boat. I wanted to go into ophthalmology. That's pretty competitive. I certainly don't want to step on anybody's toes. And so there certainly were things that in hindsight, I wish I had spoken out about. But in fact, the truth of the matter is I felt uncomfortable to speak out. And no one ever directly said, boy, there'll be retaliation if you say or do that. But at some level, I had internalized that it wasn't safe for me to do that. And so I didn't. And so as I progressed through residency, I felt more comfortable. This is a little bit of an epiphany as I'm thinking here. As I got to residency, I felt very good about being an ally. That was the thing that was easiest for me first. So when I saw other people not being treated fairly, if it was a student, if it was a patient, if it was somebody that I saw suffering some sort of inequity, I felt very comfortable to speak out for them. You know, why did you do that? What were you thinking? And then the last thing that came on board was for me to be able to feel comfortable to speak out for myself and say, I'm the target of this. This is, and to do it in the moment. And I think that is probably the most challenging thing, to gather your thoughts, recognize what's going on, assess the context that you're in, that it is appropriate to have this discussion, have an understanding of the person who is the microaggressor to understand what sort of relationship you want to maintain with the person who has done this, and whether that person is somebody who I really believe would want to know and would benefit from learning, and being able to engage them in a very methodical way of what happened, my interpretation of what happened, and what I'm going to ask them to do or not to in the future. So it's been a journey, Alex, in brief.
Yeah, thank you for giving us that insight. I feel like medical students and just, you know, everyday people could, you know, resonate with that, especially the part where you feel comfortable standing up for others before yourself. I feel the exact same way, like mama bear, when you like hurt anyone that I'm caring about or anything. But when it comes to me, I go, oh, well, I don't want to overreact. Or especially in the medical field, you're like, well, are they right? You have imposter syndrome because of things you've been told. And then on top of that, you just don't want to give the same, you don't want to play into their thoughts. So like I'm biracial. And I know when I get, I've been in situations where if I got really upset, they go, oh, now I see, you know, that you're mixed and that, now I get that.
Yeah, that's a microaggression.
Yeah. So, yeah, it can weigh on people. And it's nice to show that, you know, you're not going to be perfect at it right from the start, but you get there.
you won't, and you bring up such an important concept of imposter syndrome, and microaggressions actually unfortunately exacerbate imposter syndrome. And one of the ways that it does that is that in order to decrease the risk of being the target of a microaggression, very often people will dampen aspects of their identity in order to try to circumvent being on the receiving end of a microaggression. And when people do that repeatedly over time, they start to feel even inauthentic to themselves. And boy, if you're looking for a way to make imposter syndrome worse, that's a pretty good recipe for it.
Dr. Kelly, this can be off the record. Maybe we'll edit it out. Maybe we'll leave it in. But you were speaking to exactly what I talked to my therapist about this morning in my first ever therapy session, woo for therapy, but just like microaggressions and how it feeds into imposter syndrome and how you want to dampen parts of yourself in order to avoid experiencing microaggressions. And especially like for me looking forward into third year, like I was literally talking with her today about like, and you know, we didn't really dive deep into it because it was just my first session, but I was like, this is one of the things that I'm worried about and why I want to get established with therapy now is because I am worried about microaggressions for third year. And like, do I need to tailor the way that I present myself and the things that I say in the clinical rotations in order to come across as more professional or more competent or just avoid microaggressions in general, like avoid that pain and that like imposter syndrome. So I just wanted to note that because I feel like you just spoke exactly to.
And you are so right, Rachel. Microaggressions are in some way they feel physical. I mean, it's almost like somebody knocks the wind out of you. You think you're going along, and then almost out of the blue, this thing, somebody does something or says something, and it is so painful in the moment that it motivates a lot of people to go a significant distance to try to avoid being the target. And it can certainly feed imposter syndrome. No doubt about it.
I just have a follow-up question on how best you deal with it in the moment when you don't think you can address it. Cause I feel like you said, it is sometimes a physical response. And for me, I get real shaky. My like concentration, my thoughts are racing. It's hard to focus. And when you're a physician taking care of patients and like your focus and attention to detail and say you're a surgeon and you can't be super shaky and flustered, like what are some good, I don't want to say coping mechanisms, but I guess mechanisms to take a step back, calm yourself from the situation in that moment, in a short moment, so that you can continue on with whatever you're doing.
And to the best that you can, and it's not always possible, but to give yourself some breathing space. Because you just have been the target of an aggression and you're human. And that's what happens when you have been the target of an aggression. And it's like, I call it brain freeze. Your breathing gets different. Your mentation is a little bit different. And it just takes a moment. You have to just step back and give yourself some room. And to ask yourself to do something that's superhuman is a tall order. It's not always possible, but you'd be surprised at how you can, even stepping a bit back from the bedside, just to give yourself some breathing room and enough time to think about what is safest for you to do in that moment, whether it is safer to address it, to give yourself additional room, process it, and come back and address the patient, the person, the situation at another time that is best for you, or to analyze the situation and figure that, you know, I need additional help. This is really too much to ask of myself to take this on by myself.
Yeah, I think you bring up a really great point about, like, it's not black and white in the sense where you either address it then and there in the moment or you don't address it at all. We've talked about this a lot throughout the course of this episode, but finding the right space, the right time to bring it up and address the concerns that you have. And so I think that your advice to give yourself that breathing room is really important, because I think students go into situations and they're like, oh, I need to be ready for this. Like, I need to go in there, know what I'm going to say, and be ready, like be expecting it almost. And the thing about microaggressions is that they're micro. You don't always recognize that they happen in the first place, let alone like anticipate them. So I like your advice about giving yourself the breathing room, both temporally and geographically, like spatially giving yourself that room to take a breather and reset yourself.
And related to that, Rachel, very often the first response that people have to a microaggression is, wait, did that just happen? Yeah. And so just a moment to just really even recognize what happened and mm-hmm. what it meant, and to then ask yourself to immediately have the right answer at your, you know, the tip of your tongue. Sometimes you do. But if you don't, then certainly don't beat up on yourself. One of the other challenges that people have found and targets is that they go home and ruminate and beat up on themselves because they didn't say the right thing in the moment. Do not beat up on yourself. Do not.
I really needed to hear that advice. I'm definitely an overthinker after the fact for everything. So,
didn't I say this, or I could have said that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially when you, or at least for me, I take the more passive route where I just move on. And then you get kind of upset with yourself. You're like, you need to be more courageous and stand up for yourself. Like, what are you doing? I guess, wrapping up, I want to make sure we address this or ask this question, because I know our listeners really wanted to know this. But do you have any like tips or advice on healthy ways to take care of yourself after the fact, like decompress, kind of move on, knowing, you know, the next day it may happen all over again?
Right. And it is so important to take care of yourself after microaggression. And it is all too related to what we were just talking about. It is all too common that people blame themselves. And so, no, if you are the target, you are not to blame. And people begin to question their own perception of reality. No, it really happened. And that's when it's particularly important to have a social network around you, a supportive network, so that you don't feel isolated and alone to sort things out and think about things. It's also very worthwhile to have a mentor, someone who understands medicine. So your family and friends outside of medicine can be wonderful social supports, but sometimes they don't quite understand the nuance of what goes on in this very unique world of medicine that we live mm-hmm. in. And having a mentor who is in medicine, who understands microaggression, who you can go to and say, this happened, and I'm not sure do I go back and talk to the person? Do I report it? I'm trying to think this through so that you're not left by yourself to try to think these heavy things through all by yourself, unsupported. And then the other is just to take care of yourself in general, you know, sleeping, eating, the things that normal people do to take good care of themselves, that doctors should do and medical students should do too, to take care of themselves.
People sleep? What?
I know. In the real world, people sleep.
Well, Dr. Kelly, this was amazing. Thank you so much for providing all of this information. It was super educational, and I feel like I personally learned a lot and had a lot of opportunity to reflect on my personal experiences and just how I can best approach these kinds of situations in the future. So hopefully our listeners can find similar value in this conversation. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you. I've actually really been looking forward to this ever since you mentioned that you were going to do it. So I'm so grateful that you did. So.